From the KGOU studios, I'm Suzette Gorlot, the Dean of the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies, and welcome to Worldviews. It's been a little over a week since Typhoon Haiyan slammed the Philippines, leaving thousands dead and devastating the city of Tacloban. I'll also talk with Joshua Landis about a so-called wild card in Syria's civil war, private funding of the rebels by wealthy donors.
You know, you can be a hawk donor, a lion donor, a bear cub. It's the same use of what we've seen pioneered in America for fundraising.
And later, Adriana Beltran joins me to discuss how clandestine criminal organizations infiltrate Guatemala's judicial system.
So they'll use them, you know, to prevent any kind of conviction when it comes to human rights cases, or to ensure that, you know, the system operates for their benefit, but not for the benefit of the whole.
Security and violence in Central America. The news is next. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gorlot. Joshua Landis, thank you for being here.
It's a pleasure as always.
So, of course, the big news this week is the super typhoon Haiyan in the Philippines. There are thousands of people dead, cities that have just been completely devastated. And you know, so now there's this outpouring of response, governments responding, Japan, who experienced its own natural disaster back in 2011 with the earthquake and then the massive tsunami, killing about 15,000 people. The Philippines sent lots of doctors and supplies and were engaged in that relief effort in Japan.
Japan did, yes, yeah.
And so Japan is now repaying that favor, I guess, and sending a lot of aid and doctors and nurses, others, Australia, the United States, military immediately
there. I guess
China
has been slow to step up.
But China, I guess China's been a bit stingy. I think
perhaps that reflects a geostrategic position, and that the Philippines has been the site of American bases. It's connected with Australia, Japan, in an attempt to contain China to a certain extent. Perhaps China's not feeling charitable.
But how? Why would China risk this in terms of its image? Right, the image of a country that you know has the means, but yet doesn't reach out and provide that relief and resource when needed. I mean, it's a measly amount given what it could do. So what's getting in the way? I mean, politics, obviously, geopolitics, as you mentioned. There are disputes with the Philippines and others in the region over, you know, access to the South China Sea. So you would, yeah. What
you would think that this would be a chance to step forward, mend fences. On the other hand, perhaps some see it as a chance to punish enemies and, you know, help friends and to demonstrate to the region that China counts, and if you want to be on China's side, you've got to be nice to China.
So a natural disaster is a time to do that? You think this is going to help China?
Well, it's a time to step forward. It is. And, you know, we saw Turkey and Greece make up in 1999, 2000, make up their relations when Turkey had a major earthquake. Greece stepped forward and offered help. And it turned the relationship that had been acrimonious for 100 years into a much better relationship. And so sometimes these natural disasters like this become moments for diplomacy and healing relations.
Well, it'll be interesting to see now that everybody's being very critical of the Chinese response about how it responds to that if it digs in. But the comments coming from the Chinese public about, you know, don't help them. We've, you know, they're not on our side, basically. They're not one of us. Let's, you know, we don't owe them anything is pretty amazing.
Yes. But, you know, it's interesting to see how Filipino Americans have really been stepping to center stage. Eric Spoelstra, head coach of Miami Heat, make an appeal for money. And there's been an outpouring. And this is – it's interesting to see how Filipino Americans have really become visible because of this.
Well, absolutely. So, I mean, this relief is going to be needed for some time to come. So we'll definitely be watching what's going on in the Philippines. So, Joshua, of course, back to your part of the world, Syria, some of the interesting developments there regarding private donors stepping up to support Syrian rebels. So I guess the thought is that, you know, the U.S. government, others are not doing enough. So Kuwaitis and others in the region are now offering all kinds of funds from private sources to fund these rebels and to try to defeat Assad. What is going on
There's
here with
that?
There's
been some wonderful investigative reporting recently showing how Kuwaiti private citizens are stepping up, amassing big sums of money that they're funneling into Syria and to al-Qaeda. And the Gulf Arabs have been really backing the al-Qaeda groups in Syria. And this has America very worried. And it's caused really Americans to run to the other side of the ship and to begin, if not backing Assad, at least soft peddling the rebel side. It's really undermined the rebel cause, because now America is worried about jihadists. It's worried about the Gulf Arabs, our big allies, Saudi Arabia and so forth, private donors. There's no accusation that the government of Saudi Arabia or Kuwait is funding these radicals, but private individuals are. And it brings up the whole issue of Wahhabi Islam and who are we supporting in the Gulf and how do we get on the same page in advancing liberal values?
Well, what's so remarkable here, I mean, these private donors have actually been quoted as saying, you know, we don't care who we cooperate with. We want to defeat Assad. So we'll work with Al-Qaeda. We'll work with whoever. But it's the way they're going about it is so fascinating. I mean, they're publicizing, you know, these donor campaigns are publicizing here, buy bullets for snipers and mortar rounds for this conflict, and you can earn points and get gold status and silver status. It's almost like, you know, you're going out and renting hotels and cars and, you know, getting frequent flyer miles. I mean, what is going on with that?
Well, oddly enough,
how they're going about doing this.
It is a little bit like raising money for relief of big storms like this, in the sense that all of these little militias are raising money, like NGOs. They're raising money. They're making YouTube presentations. And they're appealing to people's heartstrings. And you have all these levels. You know, you can be a hawk donor, a lion donor, a bear cub, and buy 20 bullets, mortar shells. It is extraordinary. It's the same use of what we've seen pioneered in America for fundraising.
For being fundraising, shifted for political campaigns.
For the war front.
This is just like, you know, raising money for
political But behind
political
it all,
campaigns.
It's the idea is that you're going to advance Islam, you're going to be working on the side of God and you're going to take down a dictator. And that Al-Qaeda ultimately is on the side of good. You know, that's where obviously we have a big, big problem in the Middle East.
Because as you mentioned, I mean, this is perhaps working, you know, in the wrong direction. And since it's not unifying the opposition, right? It's disaggregating,
but
competing over these private donors. It's going to be a detriment to
that. Well, it's up to the United States to fund the liberals. And that's the problem. America does not want to have to be the major funder. If we leave the situation, turn our backs on the Middle East, we see that private money is going towards Islamic radicals. And that is a big problem for the United States.
Well, it's certainly something that we can't control, I imagine. You know, these private donors say, I want to fund this. How do you control it?
And if you try to get your anti-terrorism elements in the government, in the Treasury Department, now we have 200 and something people just looking for terrorists. So if we turn that against these people, we're going to be fighting against our allies, Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, who are the pillars of our policy in the Middle East. And that's the conundrum. We can't turn that same mechanism. It's one thing going after Iran, an enemy. We can't go after Saudis and Kuwaitis in the same way.
Well, continues to be a dilemma in the Middle East. Joshua, thank you very much for being here for the roundtable.
It's always a pleasure. Thank you, Suzette.
We'd love to hear your thoughts about this show or answer any questions you may have. We're on Twitter at WorldviewsKGOU, or you can follow us at Suzette Gorelot or at Joshua_Landis. Next, I'm joined by Adriana Beltran with the Washington Office on Latin America. She studies violence prevention and police and judicial reform in Central America. I'm Suzette Gorelot, and this is Worldviews. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gorelot. Guatemala signed peace accords in 1996 to end a decades-long civil war. But even though the fighting came to an end, institutional democratic reforms never took place. The government consolidated power through corrupt relationships with organized crime and a lack of accountability over the next two decades. My guest, Adriana Beltran, studies and writes about these security issues for the Washington Office on Latin America, a non-governmental organization that focuses on human rights and social justice issues south of the U.S. border. Adriana Beltran, welcome to Worldviews.
Thank you.
You've been doing a lot of work in Central America. I mean, you're originally from Colombia, but have spent a lot of time working and in studying issues regarding security and violence and human rights, really, in Central America, and particularly Guatemala. Could you give us a little update on what is the current security situation or human rights situation like in Guatemala? I mean, we don't hear very good reports, of course, here. So give us kind of an on-the-ground assessment of what it's like there.
It's a very interesting time in Guatemala. On the one hand, I would say starting in 2010, we started seeing some very positive steps that were encouraging. One had to do with the creation of an international commission against impunity. This is a UN-led body. That was a proposal that was promoted by the civil society organizations, the human rights community, to address the problems of impunity in the country. It was an entity that was established in 2008. That has, on the one hand, tried to investigate very high-level cases of the collusion between state officials and organized crime, but also tried to present proposals for the strengthening of both the judicial body, the Attorney General's office, and the police. And through its work, one of the things that we saw in 2010 was the appointment of a very, very courageous leader as Attorney General. It was very contested process that, again, you know, brought to light a lot of the corruption and impunity that you see in the country. But her appointment has been key on many levels. One, she has managed to push forward some of the key human rights cases that had been stalled since the end of the conflict in 1996, and has also gone after organized crime. So you've seen, you know, very notorious individuals that everybody in Guatemala knew they were involved in organized crime for the first time be apprehended, be arrested, some of them facing extradition. I see this as a positive step. Obviously, you know, many of the prosecutors and people involved are still facing death threats under very, very harsh security situations. And you see setbacks in a lot of these processes, and that's how you see the impunity at work in Guatemala.
So let's just step back for a second. I want to get to this issue of corruption and organized crime and police reform. But just to go back one second and talk a little bit about the conflict in Guatemala, the conflict that ended in 1996 with the peace accords that you referred to. What was the ultimate cause of that conflict, and how could we characterize that conflict, and what was the outcome in the sense of, you know, democratic governance and stability that is now playing out in some other fashion?
You know, to characterize it in a very general way, because we could, you know, spend hours talking about the causes of the conflict, the root essentially was a system that was extremely unequal and where you had huge swaths of the population that, you know, were very poor, did not have opportunities, you know, very huge concentration of huge swaths of land. So there was a lot of inequality and disparity, which eventually led to the formation of the guerrilla groups and eventually led to the conflict. It was at a time, you know, where the U.S. was promoting a national security doctrine. It was during the Cold War. So there was a lot of push to fight any kind of left insurgency. What that led to in the case of Guatemala was one of the most atrocious conflicts that you see in the region. The UN Historical Clarification Commission, following the peace accords, you know, estimated that over 200,000 people were assassinated or disappeared. There were over 600 massacres. 93% of the human rights violations were committed by the military or paramilitaries that worked for the military, and 3% of the guerrillas. You know, the Historical Clarification Commission describes just horrible and atrocious violations committed mostly against the indigenous population. At the end, you know, what they concluded was that the state and the military did, in fact, commit acts of genocide in four specific regions of the country.
My guest is Adriana Beltran, a senior associate for citizen security at the Washington office on Latin America. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. I'm Suzette Grelot, and this is Worldviews. You're listening to Worldviews. I'm Suzette Grelot, the Dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. I'm speaking with Adriana Beltran from the Washington Office on Latin America. When we left off, she described atrocities the Guatemalan government continued to commit even after the end of the decades-long civil war. So 17 years ago, when this when these peace accords were signed and the conflict essentially came to an end, rather than beginning this process of institutionalizing democratic reform and processes, these groups, these various players that were engaged in the conflict then took power in some other way by developing criminal networks and corrupt relations with those in government. And those are the institutions, basically, that have emerged and have strengthened throughout this time since the end of the conflict.
I think in Guatemala, it's a very popular or common phrase. It's called hidden powers. What this essentially means are parallel powers. And what this essentially describes is it's what's going on in Guatemala. Like you described, the elites in certain very influential sectors, you know, established institutions, the judicial sector, the police, and many of the bodies that were called for in the peace accords. But they build them in a way that they also have a lot of influence of who you put in key places. So essentially, they'll allow them to function to the degree that they want them to function, but to their own benefit. So they'll use them, you know, to prevent any kind of conviction when it comes to human rights cases or to protect in case of criminal wrongdoing, to ensure that, you know, the system operates for their benefit but not for the benefit of the whole. And that's what, you know, Guatemalans mean as parallel powers and the influence of very influential sectors that essentially have not seen a need for building a democratic country.
So how does this situation compare to other countries in Central America? I mean, Guatemala is not the only country that has experienced a similar background, a similar history. So how does it fare in comparison to El Salvador, or maybe Honduras in the region?
The Northern Triangle of Central America, so what's the comprised of Guatemala, El Salvador, and Honduras, currently has some of the highest homicide rates in the world. Honduras, for example, has the highest homicide rate of any country globally. It's right now, according to the last figures, about 85 per 100,000. They experienced the wars of the 80s very differently. I would say in the case of El Salvador, the peace accords there that were signed in 1992 were able to advance a lot more than in the case of Guatemala. So you have a bit of stronger institutionality in the country, particularly when it comes to the police. That said, you know, because of the security situation, and now you have, you know, new threats, organized crime, you have, you know, the issue of the youth gangs, it has debilitated the institutions. And so we start now seeing more interference of organized crime within the institutions. In the case of Honduras, there was a coup in 2009. The situation was also one of a lot of inequality. Unfortunately, one of the impacts of the coup was to debilitate even more very fragile institutions. So what you have right now is extremely high levels of corruption and infiltration of organized crime in the institutions. They've been trying to push, you know, police reform, security sector reforms. But, you know, these have not advanced, and I would say in large part because you have just a lot of infiltration, a lot of linkages between very powerful individuals and criminality.
So very quickly then, what is the solution here? What do we need to be looking to the international community or to these own governments themselves to be doing to address these serious problems with security and human rights violations?
On the part of the international community, there's a significant amount of funding that is provided, not just by the United States government, but by other governments and multilateral institutions. I think it's very key that the international community use both its financial and political support to push very clearly for a reform agenda. And by that, I mean focus on the strengthening of the institutions, on building, you know, effective, professional criminal justice institutions, the police. Making sure that the focus of their assistance is geared in that direction. Support for civil society, because I think that's key, and they've played a remarkable role in trying to push many of these processes forward at grave risk. And I think that's where not just international governments, but people can lend their support to let the governments know that there is international attention, that there is concern, and also support for very courageous individuals, even within the institutions. You have, you know, the Attorney General that I mentioned, but you also have many prosecutors and judges that are willing to risk their lives for making, you know, good and professional decisions.
What about generational change? I mean, is this going to change, I suppose, with the generations as you have some of these other people leave power and young people coming up?
I mean, that's the hope of many. You know, one of the questions that I've often asked myself, particularly when it comes to the elite, is if a new generation, particularly given the concerns of organized crime and even threats that they face, will that lead them to support a more reformative agenda? Are there changes now even within the police and military because you have the old guard kind of leaving? And how can you, you know, push reform processes to ensure that these new people that are emerging have a different vision of what their country ought to look like? But also to how do you build, you know, civil society, and how do you get generations that, you know, in the case of Guatemala, didn't necessarily experience the conflict to understand their own history? You know, in that, in one of the setbacks or issues of the peace accords that was never implemented was the need to include in the curriculum mention of the conflict, and that hasn't happened. So oftentimes when you're talking to younger Guatemalans, they don't really know their own history.
Well, that would definitely be important for any kind of future change. Well, Adriana Beltran, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for inviting me.
You've been listening to my conversation with Adriana Beltran from the Washington Office on Latin America. You can read the study she mentioned, Hidden Powers, on our website, kgou.org. Worldviews is a collaborative partnership between the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies and KGOU. Hillary Gibson prepares the research for our interviews, and Brian Hardzinski produces the show and our digital content. For Joshua Landis, I'm Suzette Gorlott.